Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does our sense of touch connect us to the world outside our own bodies? And does it rely on the connection between our bodies and brains? We're quick to recognize the vast amounts of information we glean from our sight and our hearing, yet our sense of touch plays into everything from our ability to know where we are in space, to grasping and manipulating objects, to giving and receiving physical comfort and pleasure, and recoiling from painful stimuli. Touch is vital to normal brain development and attachment. And as my guest will tell us, our experience of touch is affected not only by our physiological wiring, but by emotional context. David J. Linden is professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His latest book is called Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And just to let you know, it is possible our discussion about the science of touch may include some references to human sexuality. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
It's amazing to think about this because we are always experiencing the sense of touch, and yet it really only bubbles up in our consciousness when something feels particularly good or particularly bad.
That's absolutely true. I think part of the reason why touch fades into the background is because it's always on. We can all imagine the loss of sight by closing our eyes or imagine being deaf by plugging our ears. We can close our nostrils. But you can't turn off your touch sense. And as a consequence, it tends to fade in the background and be discounted.
And yet if we've ever been to the dentist and felt numb for an hour after that's over, everybody knows how distracting it is.
That's absolutely true. And that brings up an interesting point, because when you go to the dentist and you get an injection of lidocaine to numb your mouth, you're blocking all the different kinds of touch receptors, the ones for pain, the ones for light touch and pressure and vibration and temperature. All of them are shut down. What we would like to make would be a kind of local anesthetic that only blocked the pain-conveying nerve fibers and left the other ones intact, so you wouldn't have that horrible sensation.
We'll be talking a lot today about the emotional context of touch. And to set that up, it's so interesting that you note we seem to have understood this long before science came along to confirm it in the way that language developed. We talk about emotions as feelings. We are touched by things that stir us emotionally, and that is not limited to English.
That's true. So the use of my feelings to mean my tender emotions and I'm touched to mean I'm emotionally affected is not merely a construction of modern-day English. In English, it goes back at least to the 13th century, perhaps before, and it can be found in many languages across the world. It seems to be a general construction. And when you see something in language that is broad cross-culturally, that's usually a hint that there is some neurobiological basis underlying it.
And of course, people walking around are all approximately the same temperature, and yet when we describe individuals as being warm or cold, everybody knows exactly what that means.
That's precisely right. So social psychologists have studied the way people form impressions of others very rapidly. When you meet someone for the first time, within 30 seconds, you have already formed a fairly strong impression of them. And we're very attuned to this. We're very good at these social cues of reading differences in facial expression or vocal tone or knowing where someone's eyes are pointed and interpreting those. And the first dimension that we evaluate when we meet someone new is, are they warm or are they cold? Meaning, are they trustworthy, friendly, warm, or are they potentially a threat? And then the second dimension we evaluate is, are they competent or incompetent? In other words, does it matter? If someone's a threat but they aren't incompetent, then you don't have to attend to them.
We were watching the Super Bowl over the weekend, and my daughter noted that there's a lot of not just the butt patting that everybody talks about, but helmet tapping or stroking among team members. And there is, I suppose, to be gleaned from that some kind of emotional cohesion?
Well, there really is. So there is a study done of teams in the National Basketball Association. And so what some folks did is they got a hold of a whole season's worth of games of all the teams in the NBA. And they viewed all the games and they scored incidents of celebratory touch. And so this means chest bumps, high fives, high tens, butt pats, all the sort of things that you might imagine. And then they asked the question, did the teams that had more celebratory touch, did they have more success? Did they win more games? And did they play in a way that was more altruistic? In other words, would people pass off to another player who had a better shot than they did? And that would be something that would benefit the team at their own individual expense. And the answer is that the teams that had more celebratory touch played better, more altruistically as a team and had more success. And you might think, oh, no, that's just a statistical problem. The teams that do better celebrate more, so this is trivial. But you can mathematically make a correction to remove that and find that independent of that, that celebratory touch is associated with greater success.
So are entire cultures affected by a similar phenomenon? You know, in some places you hug someone that you're meeting for the first time. In other places you kiss them on the cheek. Sometimes you shake hands and sometimes you maybe just stand back and say hello.
Well, obviously culture has an enormous amount to do with how social touch occurs and particularly how social touch occurs between the sexes. There's a famous study that was done by Sidney Gerard in the 1960s where he sat in cafes and he observed people in Latin America and in the United States and in London and Paris. And he found, I don't remember the precise numbers, it was something on the order of 200 touches in an hour in Latin America and maybe 10 touches an hour in the United States and 20 touches an hour in France and 0 touches an hour in London. So there are enormous cultural determinants. But I think the thing that's important is that social touch is a kind of glue. It binds sexual partners into lasting couples. It binds families together. When it is appropriate, it can bind people in the workplace, whether that workplace is an NBA team or an office together and promote trust, altruism, and mutual cooperation.
Of course, you know, you mentioned when it's appropriate. There are these very strict, if unwritten, rules about who's allowed to touch whom and under what conditions. And it's fascinating that the sort of caress that feels wonderful from somebody we're close to, not even necessarily a sexual caress, is downright off-putting, which, by the way, I guess is another touch emotion metaphor, from a stranger or somebody we don't like.
Well, that's true. Imagine an arm around your shoulder from, say, a good buddy of yours versus someone who's hitting on you in a bar versus a domineering boss versus your sweetheart when you're feeling warm and connected versus your sweetheart when you're in the middle of an argument and the argument isn't resolved. It's not just that the sensation of this touch, the exact same arm around the shoulder with the same pressure and the same location on your body and all the physical aspects being identical. It's not just that it feels the same, but then upon reflection, you interpret it differently. It literally feels differently. And the reason it does that is because higher areas of the brain, areas in the frontal cortex that are concerned with social context, send messages to the part of the brain called the primary somatosensory cortex, where the actual physical sensation of touch is received, and change that activity in order to change the perception.
Why do babies need to be touched, and how do babies need to be touched to facilitate proper brain development?
Well, we know that when newborns and toddlers are touch deprived, as occurred in Romanian orphanages in the 1980s and 90s, there's a whole host of disastrous consequences. The kids develop compulsive rocking, self-soothing behaviors. They have attachment disorders. They have mental retardation, and it's not just limited to neuropsychiatric problems. They have poor development of the immune system and the gastrointestinal system, and if they don't receive this touch in the first 2 years of life, these problems persist into adulthood, and you see higher levels of diabetes, psychiatric problems, a whole host of maladies. And I think the important thing is to contrast this with the loss of other senses, right? If you're born blind, you can be fine. You can have a completely rich life. Your cognitive and emotional functions, the development of your body will be normal. Same if you're born deaf. But if you're born with the sense of touch, but you don't receive that loving touch in the early part of your life, a disaster unfolds. Now, why that is on a level of molecules and cells, we don't yet understand.
Does our need for touch diminish after our brains are fully cooked?
No, it doesn't diminish. It just changes. It changes from being necessary for the development of the mind, brain, and body to being necessary for proper social integration into the world and developing human bonds.
We have an email here from Morgan who says, I'm curious about touch starvation and how to combat it if you're very reclusive. The usual advice is to go out and meet people or variations thereof. That's not only very simplistic, but simply not an option for everyone.
Right. Well, that is an extremely good question. And so while interpersonal touch is ideal for people who just really can't stand to touch other people, even touching yourself, and I don't necessarily mean sexually in this context, although that's good as well, even self-massage is beneficial. It's better to have interpersonal touch. And I think the important thing to realize is that there can be contexts for interpersonal touch that are neither sexual nor aggressive. But people do become starved for this. There's a terrific story by the wonderful fiction writer Laurie Moore that came out of The New Yorker a few years ago. And it was about this woman who was really touch-starved and was saying how she loved to go to the salon to have her head massaged. And then when she went to the airport, she would always opt for the pat-down at the TSA rather than going through the scanner, because while most people found that intrusive, it was actually beneficial for her.
There was a thing in the New York Times recently, I think, about professional cuddlers, these people that you can hire. It's not prostitution, like you go and, I guess, pay this service to cuddle up to you. And I was wondering, given the association we have with emotion and sort of gentle, friendly touch, do you think that works in the same way that it works if you're being cuddled by somebody who cares about you?
I think it's all dependent on context. I think if you're in the right mindset, if you are the sort of person who makes the effort to go out and hire a professional cuddler, it'll probably be beneficial. I think if you're not the sort of person who's comfortable with that and the professional cuddler comes up and starts cuddling you, I don't think it would be. The important thing to realize, this is true about touch, but it is true about all sensation, is that context is key. And I'd like to explain this by relating my very favorite cartoon in the world. And in this cartoon, which is drawn by Julia Wirtz, there are a man and a woman sitting in a car. The man is driving. The woman has a bag of groceries on her lap. And the man says, "P.U., what stinks in here?" And the woman says, "That's the delicious cheese we just bought." And then he says, "Oh, then what's so wonderful smelling in here?" Everything is context dependent.
We're speaking this hour with David J. Linden, professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and author of the new book, Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
The
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David J. Linden, professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and author of the new book, Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, David, there are two big categories of skin in different regions of the body, skin that has hair and skin that doesn't. And it turns out they function in really different ways from one another.
Yes, they do. And I think it's important to realize that almost everywhere on the body, even places we think of not being particularly hairy, often have tiny hairs. So, for example, the skin of the nose or the upper cheek in both men and women is actually hairy skin. The only places that are hairless are the soles of the feet and the palms of the hands and the lips and the nipples and a few other locations. But it turns out that hairy skin is special because it has caress sensors located in it. And these are special nerve endings that wrap around the base of hairs and sense hair deflection. So when you are being caressed on the arm, the hair deflections activate these what are called C-tactile fibers, and then they project to a part of the brain that is not there for determining the facts of touch. It's not there for saying, well, exactly where on your body are you being touched and with what quality and with what strength, but rather to decode the emotional intention. And that is where the positive emotions from being caressed are generated.
I tried this. I, you know, you can take two fingers and sort of stroke the back of your hand and it feels one way, and then do the same thing on your palm and it feels completely different.
It does, absolutely. It's even more dramatic if you're not doing it to yourself, if someone else does it. But the other thing that's interesting is that we are actually tuned to like a particular speed, pressure, and temperature of caress. The temperature, not surprisingly, is the temperature of human skin. But just imagine if someone's caressing your arm and they are doing it really, really, really slowly. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel loving. It feels like a bug and you want to flick it off. And likewise, if someone skims their hand over your arm really fast, that doesn't feel really good either. There is a range of speeds that feels good. And you might think to yourself, oh, well, that's because your brain has circuits in it that are tuned for this range of speeds. But remarkably, if you stick a needle in the arm and record from the nerves that are carrying that caress information from the skin to the spinal cord and there to the brain, what you find is that the selectivity for the range of speeds that feel good is already there in those nerves before the information even got to the brain. To me, that's amazingly surprising.
It occurred to me as well that of all the pets I've had, I've tried to take good care of all of them, but nothing compares to the ones that you can put in your lap and cuddle with.
Oh, yeah. There are tremendous benefits for interaction with pets, particularly with an interaction with a pet with which you've developed a social bond. And there are a whole raft of studies that have shown, not surprisingly, reduction in blood pressure, anxiety, relief of depression, and this is particularly true in the elderly, particularly in institutional settings where people may not be receiving as much loving touch as they did in other parts of their life. It's actually gotten to the point where, because in some institutions you really can't have, say, a typical dog or cat sort of pet, that there is a Japanese-developed animatronic baby seal named Paro that has been used very effectively. And it's good for people with senile dementia and elderly folks with depression as well.
What can we feel and perceive with our fingertips that we can't do with most of the rest of our bodies?
Well, certain places, you know, we think of, well, where on our skin is really sensitive? So our fingertips are sensitive. The small of the back is not very sensitive. But it turns out that sensitive isn't a good enough word to really divide up this sensation. So, for example, the cornea of your eye or a woman's clitoris or the head of a man's penis are all areas that are very sensitive in the sense that they can detect very tiny deflections of the skin. But those areas can't distinguish fine tactile forms. So you know, for example, if you get a bit of sand in your eye, it hurts like hell, but you can't actually tell exactly where in your eye it is. Whereas if you roll that grain of sand on your fingertip or on your lip or on your tongue, you know exactly what it is. So if you want to read Braille, you can read Braille with your lips or your fingertips, but you can't read Braille with your cornea or your genitals. Now, if your readers don't if your listeners don't believe me, they can wait till no one's around at the ATM and they can try it out for themselves.
I wouldn't recommend that, though. My guest is David J. Linden. He's professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. David, how do we perceive pressure, and what would happen if that finely tuned perception, particularly in, I guess, our hands, didn't work right?
Well, so we have a sensor for fine tactile form called the Merkel ending, which is the one you need to read Braille. We have one for microscopic slips, and this is the kind of the thing you need. Say, for example, you're picking up an egg. You want to have exert enough pressure so that it doesn't slip out of your hand, but not so much that you crush it. The same thing if you're holding a child's hand. And the way you do that is by detecting the tiny microscopic slips between the object you're holding and your fingertips. And those are from an ending called a Meissner. So all these endings have names of anatomists from long ago. The one that I think is perhaps most interesting is called the Pacinian ending. And the Pacinian ending senses vibrations. And this is particularly good for determining what's happening at the end of a tool that you're holding in your hand. So, for example, if you're playing the violin and the hand that's holding the bow, you can feel the texture and the tautness of the violin strings through your bow transmitted all the way to your fingertips. Or if you're driving a car, by holding the steering wheel and getting vibrations that are transmitted all the way from the road to the tires, through the steering linkage, through the steering wheel, you can get a sense of whether the road surface is grippy or slippery. And this entirely depends upon the Pacinian endings in your fingertips, and these are also present in other places as well.
And I guess the complexity of that function is one reason why we have struggled so mightily to make like mechanical prosthetics that really work to do everything that, say, a human hand could do.
Right now, sensory prosthetics with touch sense in them are extraordinarily crude. You would imagine, for example, for something like laparoscopic surgery, that this would be enormously beneficial. You would want to be able to – if the surgeon could feel feedback from what's happening at the tip of the tool, this could be very useful. This is an area that's in its infancy but is very, very actively being researched. So I think you're going to find sensory feedback and so-called haptic display devices coming up all over the place. I just wrote an article for Wired called "In the Future, Your Touchscreen Will Touch You Back." That is just about those sorts of things that are coming down the road.
Yeah, and the idea is, I guess, in those cases, there will be maybe an electrical pulse or something that hits our brains in such a way that it feels as if we're touching an object that is multidimensional.
Well, there's a couple of different ways to do this. If you want to, like, display a texture on your touchscreen that you could explore with your fingertips, one way would be to literally have a screen that had little plungers underneath it that could create bumps to physically create the texture. The other way would be to put your finger down and then pass tiny little electrical currents into your fingertip to artificially activate the nerve endings there and thereby transmit signals to your brain. At present, the former is fairly well developed. The latter is still very much in the middle of development.
We sure like to touch things when we're deciding if we want to own it or buy it. And I was thinking about the fact that whenever, inevitably, when someone says, let me see that, they mean hand it to me so that I can touch it as well.
Absolutely. I mean, this is another place where our language gives a clue. If we've had a bad time, we come home, we say, I've had a rough day. If someone is evasive, we'd say, oh, that guy is really slippery in conversation. We use these touch terms all the time and really don't even think about them as being literally related to touch. But you're absolutely right that the tactile is important in buying decisions, particularly for clothing. You'll see people like, you know, pick up a shirt and hold it to their cheek. Recently, there was a survey done by a marketing company of people who had just bought cell phones. And you would think, oh, this is a technological item. People are all concerned about the processor and the resolution of the display and the software that's available. And it turns out that for about a third of the people, they reported that the most important aspect of their decision was how it felt cradled in their palm.
So what's the relationship between our perception of touch and physical pain? Because we can feel pain in organs that we don't associate with the kind of touch that we feel in our skin. And, of course, we can feel touch. We can feel pain on the surface of the body.
Right. So there are specialized pain receptors that are present in the nerve endings of the skin and also in the nerve endings that innervate the viscera. I think the important thing to realize is that touch is many, many different kinds of sensors acting in parallel: heat, cold, pain, itch, light touch, vibration. These are all separate channels. They are combined in our consciousness, and we don't experience them as separate. We think of touch as a unified gestalt, but that's just an illusion our brain cooks up for us.
How do we perceive that something is wet? I had never thought to ask that question until I read your book.
Well, this brings up a really interesting both sort of philosophical and biological point. So everyone knows what wet is or oily is or itch is. And so this brings the question, well, do we have special nerve endings that are tuned for detecting wetness or oiliness or itch? And the answer is that for wetness and oiliness, no. These are touch blends. So wetness is both a temperature and a mechanical sense sensation. Oiliness has a lot to do with activation of those microslip sensors. For years, people argued, and some people said, itch doesn't have a specialized sensor. It's merely a pattern of activity of sensors. And other people said, no, there are dedicated sensors for itch. And we now know that there are at least some dedicated sensors for itch in the mouse and presumably also in the human. And the exciting thing about that is because we can identify these on a molecular basis, we can now develop new anti-itch drugs that will be much more effective. So when you get poison ivy and you use a cream, right now the cream doesn't really work and it's agonizing. 10 years from now, we'll have a cream that's much better because of this research.
It's funny that itch doesn't really radiate. Like, you know exactly where it itches, and scratching anywhere else doesn't really do much good.
Yeah, itch is very localized, and we think, we hypothesize that itch developed so that we would flick parasites off our bodies. And as a consequence, you want to flick at the very right location on your body, not miss.
So parents who have dealt with kids who have head lice sometimes will report, oh, I'll just say it. A few years ago, my kids had lice, and I never got it, but I felt itchy for days. What was going on there?
Oh, we're incredibly suggestible when it comes to itch. So if you merely see someone else scratching or even watch a video of someone scratching, even when you're saying the word head lice, just right now I'm sitting in the studio and I'm feeling a little bit crawly, even just from those words. What this points out is that touch sensation and itch in particular are completely dependent upon what our expectation is. A great example of this is, imagine you're picking up your mug and you're expecting coffee, and instead there's tea in your mug. You'll go, patooey, even if you like tea. In other words, our perception isn't determined by the absolute parameters of what happens. It's dependent upon comparing what we expect to happen with what really does happen.
Okay, so what's going on with tickling?
Oh, tickling. That's a great thing. So it turns out that we are hardwired to discount sensations that result from moving our own body. And this is because we really want to attend mostly to things in the external world because they are more likely to be things that we need to interact with because they are threatening or tasty or whatever. And so, you know, if you're walking down the street, for example, your clothes are moving against your body, but you really don't think about it at all. You don't pay attention to that sensation. And yet, if you were standing still and then you had the sensation of your clothes moving on the body in the same way that they did when you were walking, then you would be very startled and you would attend to that very closely. And it's the same way with tickling. When you tickle yourself, the parts of your brain that are generating the messages that will move your arm and your hand to initiate the tickling, those messages are not just sent down to the nerves that activate your muscles, they're also copied and sent to your cerebellum, which is a motor control center. And from there, they are sent to the sensory areas of your brain to turn down the sensations that are associated with that tickling. And as a consequence, you don't have a very strong tickling sensation when you tickle yourself unless you're a person who has damage to their cerebellum, in which case then you can tickle yourself.
So is that also the case for people with the kinds of sensory processing disorders that cause them to sort of constantly be aware of the feeling of the cloth on their skin?
That's a great question. No, those are usually not associated with cerebellar damage. Those are different.
We're speaking this hour with David J. Linden, who is professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His new book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. We'll come back to the conversation in a few minutes. If you've got a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with neuroscience professor David J. Linden of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His new book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. David, let's talk a little bit more about pain. What accounts for the fact that you can, say, stub your toe and it takes a half a second for that horrible rush of pain to begin?
Yeah, so I think everyone has had this sensation. When you stub your toe, there are actually two different waves of pain. There's one very rapid one that's kind of sharp that gets to your brain very quickly. And then you can sing, In a Gata Da Vida, baby, before the second wave of pain comes. And the second wave of pain has a different quality. It is more aching and throbbing. So the first pain, which gets there through big, thick, fast-conducting nerve fibers, is a type of pain that has a lot of information in it. It's there to guide withdrawal responses. It's the kind of pain that will have you pull your finger back from a hot stove, for example. The slow, lingering, strongly emotionally negative component of pain guides much slower behaviors like, do I need to limp to favor this injury to avoid aggravating it? And that slow part of pain is what strongly activates the brain's emotional pain circuitry. We think of pain as being intrinsically emotionally negative, but actually there's two different parts of the brain involved. One is sort of just the facts of pain. Where is it on my body? What's the characteristic of the pain? You know, stabbing, burning, etc. How strong is it? And then there's the emotionally negative aspect of pain. And normally these things are fused. But people who have damage to their emotional pain center have a condition called pain asymbolia. And if you whack them on the thumb with a hammer, they'll say in a very flat voice, yes, that hurts. It hurts a lot. It's on my thumb. And it's quite painful. But they won't say, oh, shoot, ah, that hurts, that's horrible, the way someone would normally. It has no emotional resonance for them. They're not masochists. Masochists like pain. For them, it has a positive emotional valence. Pain asymbolics, pain has no emotional meaning whatsoever.
Can the emotions floating around the room before something that causes us pain have an impact on how strongly or lightly we feel it?
Oh, absolutely. Context is key. In the book, I talk about a case of a soldier, an American soldier who served in Iraq named Dwayne Turner. And he was with his unit and he came under attack and a grenade detonated nearby him. And he took shrapnel all up and down his body. And he didn't even know that he had been struck. And they came under attack and Dwayne Turner rescued 12 of his fallen comrades and pulled them out of the line of fire. He was awarded the Silver Star for Valor by the Army, who estimated that he saved 12 people's lives that day. And at the end, as he was rushing out to fight some more, the medic said, hey, you've been hit. You've got shrapnel on your leg. You're bleeding. And he goes, no, that's not me. That's someone else's blood. Hmm. And then he looks and goes, oh, it is me. And it doesn't diminish his heroism in any way to note that this is a very common thing among soldiers in combat. In that context, pain doesn't register very strongly. What's amazing is that these same soldiers, if they're 3 days later in the field hospital and someone does a bad job drawing blood from their arm, the minor pain of that, they'll complain about it just like anyone else would. The converse example comes from my own youth. I remember as a kid going to the pediatrician and just dreading getting a routine immunization. And when you think about it, it's really not that painful. Falling down on the playground and skinning your knee hurts a lot more, but you don't anticipate it. And so by the time, you know, I smelled the alcohol pad and I was so nervous and clenching up, when that needle went into my arm, it felt like a steak knife was being inserted and rotated. It hurt so much. But in reality, that pain was just being amplified by the situation and by my mounting anxiety.
So the anticipation literally makes it worse.
It does. There's a horrible positive feedback loop between the unpleasantness of pain, the way that is perceived, and anxiety. And in chronic pain, these things feed off each other. People who suffer from chronic pain are always worrying, how long will the pain go on? When will it come back? How is it going to be? And this is part of the reason why both anti-anxiety drugs can reduce chronic pain, even though they don't act directly on pain perception, and why practices like mindfulness, meditation, and forms of movement movement modulation that become very conscious, like Alexander technique or Feldenkrais technique, why all of these things can be effective in attenuating chronic pain as well. It's because pain is so under such cognitive and emotional and attentional control.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Pamela on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if the skin that has hair on it, if it's in any way affected by hair removal, and if So is there a difference between temporary hair removal like shaving as opposed to permanent hair removal like waxing or a laser hair removal?
So that's a great question. Yes. So when you remove the hair shaft, either permanently or temporarily, then you are no longer able to receive hair deflection signals that come from a caress. So those parts of the body where the hair is removed are no longer going to be able to transduce that caress sensation. Now, that was a good aspect of the question about the difference between permanent hair removal. So when you have permanent hair removal, does your brain reorganize as a consequence of that? And my guess would be, yes, it does. But I'm not aware of any study that has addressed that. So we know that when you change your sensation in a long-term basis, that this literally rewires your brain. So, for example, your body surface is represented in a map of your body in an area called the somatosensory cortex where you feel touch. Women who are breastfeeding, not surprisingly, the nipple representation on that map expands to become bigger while they're breastfeeding, and when they stop breastfeeding, it contracts back to its normal size. People who play the violin, their fingering hands representation becomes bigger in this map, and then if they stop playing the violin, it returns to its normal size. So my guess is that with laser hair removal, there would be a subtle reorganization of the brain's touch centers as a consequence.
Do you know anything about the surface of the scalp? So many people have the experience of losing their hair as they get older, and I suppose there's almost always still a little bit left, but I wonder if the scalp becomes more or less sensitive.
That's a great question. I don't really know about the C tactile caress sensor fiber innervation of the scalp in particular. I would imagine it would function just like other parts of the body, but I don't know that for sure.
I was interested to read that the diminishing sensitivity of our feet as we age may be a factor in the risk of falls to the elderly, which is not something I think that most people think about when they are trying to understand why this happens as we age.
Yeah, it turns out the bad news is that starting at age 20, we lose about 1% of our touch conveying nerve endings in our skin every year. It happens very, very gradually. We don't tend to notice it until we're elderly. And we lose all kinds of sensation, heat, cold, pain, temperature, pressure, etc. So there are a lot of problems with this in the elderly. Part of the reason why the elderly can have bed sores that you would think would be horribly painful and not report them is because their pain sensation is so strongly reduced. And there are a lot of reasons that contribute to falls in the elderly having to do with muscle weakness and problems with balance sense. But one of the contributors is a reduction in the touch sense in the soles of the feet. And so it's harder to feel the changing ground under your feet and adjust your stance correctly, and as a result, this is a contributor to fall injuries.
So often we see older folks in like really sturdy, thick-soled shoes. I wonder if that might not be the best idea.
Well, it turns out that you can sense better if you're barefoot. However, there is also a benefit from having a really grippy surface on the bottom of your foot. So there are some studies that have said that going barefoot is really an advantage because you can feel better through your soles. There are others said, well, that is true, but actually you're better off with a thin, grippy surface so that you reduce slipping.
So, David, people are doing brain games to keep their brain strong and they exercise to keep their bodies fit. Are there things we can do to maybe minimize the effect of our diminishing touch sensations as we age?
There are, but I can't let that go by. Brain games are nonsense. They're an utter waste of money. They're a scam. Don't do them. Physical exercise is the very, very, very most important thing you can do, particularly as you age, to maintain your brain fitness. It's perfectly great to be cognitively active and to do puzzles and learn languages and be out there in the world to maintain your cognitive health. But these brain games that are being peddled have tiny effects that don't generalize very well. So my advice to your listeners is to save your money. Now, to get to your actual question, which is about what we can do to maintain our touch sense. Unfortunately, the nerve endings are going to die away no matter what we do. But there's evidence that if you keep being touched and touching throughout your life, that there are lots of benefits to this in aging. There's sort of a use it or lose it phenomena for many aspects of our brain and peripheral nervous system, and it's true in touch as well.
Are there, obviously there are always scientific questions and mysteries out there, but is there something in this line of research that is really lighting people on fire right now?
I would say the most interesting aspect to me right now is understanding these different touch sensors at a molecular level and what this will mean in terms of our ability to make therapies. Right now, drugs to control pain are awful. In other words, they work very well. Morphine and related drugs work very well, but they have all these horrible side effects in there, and they're deeply addicting. Now that we are starting to understand the fine molecular detail of how nerves convey pain signals to the brain, we are going to be able to make pain-killing drugs that that are just as effective with much fewer bad side effects. Likewise, our identification of molecular itch receptors will allow us to make itch creams that are much better, local analgesics that are much better. And of course, thinking to the far, far future, there will be a time where we will be able to have virtual reality that not just simulates sight and sound, but simulates touch as well.
Why, when I drink hot peppermint tea during a show, do I still get the sensation that my mouth is cool?
Well, when you drink hot peppermint tea, you're getting two conflicting messages. So you have heat sensors in your mouth that are conveying that information to your brain. But in the mint, there's its active ingredient is a chemical called menthol. And menthol artificially activates cold receptors and gives you a cooling sensation. It turns out the idea that things like chili peppers being called hot and mint being called cool, this isn't just a local construction. This is something that you find all over the world, and it's because the active ingredient in chili peppers, capsaicin, artificially activates heat receptors, and because the active ingredient in mint, menthol, artificially activates cool receptors.
David J. Linden is professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His latest book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. David, it's been a really fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.